2. The Tale of Two Thinkers. Vienna, 1895 to 1906. Famous physicist Ernst Mach hired as philosopher. Mach makes ready to meet philosophy halfway. Analyzes shock waves, science's history, dizziness, and other sensations. Rejects thing in itself. Rejects atoms. Rejects ego and absolute space. Assaults metaphysics. Though celebrated by Waltz Giddy Vienna, Mach bows out after stroke. Physicist Boltzmann takes over. Boltzmann claims atoms are needed, claims disorder increases, claims to be his own successor. Likens metaphysics to migraines, suffers from both. Hanging suicide of Boltzmann. It came as no surprise, writes Mach. Student hires professor. In 1895, an otherwise unremarkable university administration took the bold step of appointing a physicist to a chair in philosophy. The university was in Vienna. The physicist's name? Ernst Mach. During the 19th century, forbidding walls between the disciplines were starting to grow, and academic hierarchies were becoming more and more rigid. If an elderly scientist took to dabbling in philosophy, well, that was his own affair, but to entrust him with a chair in philosophy, when he had not even studied Kant or the Scholastics, was seen as highly out of order. The enterprise started well enough. The university chair in Vienna seemed made to measure for Mach. But after only a few years, he had to resign out of the blue when a sudden stroke paralyzed him. His lectures were then entrusted to another physicist, the celebrated Ludwig Boltzmann. However, this too lasted but a few years, for Boltzmann committed suicide by hanging himself. It seemed as if a beautiful new tradition, having physicists teach philosophers, had been nipped in the bud. Nonetheless, it was out of that novel tradition that the Vienna Circle was to grow a couple of decades later. The two world-renowned physicists had imbued an entire generation of students with their passion for philosophy. Mach and Boltzmann were alike not just in their looks, but also in their careers. They had similar heavy physiques, bushy beards and thin-rimmed glasses. In their youths, they learned from the same teachers, and as university students they both enjoyed great success. Most importantly, Mach and Boltzmann were headstrong and opinionated, and they relished it. Neither of them ever shied away from any philosophical controversy, least of all from debating each other. Their fierce debate about the reality of atoms became part of the great lore of the history of science. Curiously enough, Mach's appointment as a philosophy professor came about largely because of a mere student, and that student later turned things around by getting his PhD under Mach's supervision. This was irregular by any standards. However, that student, Heinrich Gomperz, 1873 to 1942, was not just anybody. He was a young man with connections. The Gomperz family was one of the wealthiest and most influential families in the city. It stood on a par with the Rothschilds, the Wittgensteins, the Liebens, the Gutmanns, and the Effussis, the fabulously wealthy Jewish dynasties of Vienna's liberal Gründerzeit, or Age of the Founders, which referred to those who had founded financial and commercial enterprises spanning Central Europe. The Habsburg dual monarchy, that is, the Austrian Empire and the Kingdom of Hungary, was firmly established, and its new oligarchs were enjoying an unprecedented economic boom. This provided them with luxurious town palaces, most of them on the Ringstrasse, Vienna's new circular boulevard, with castle-like country resorts and private sleeping cars, with glittery balls orchestrated by Johann Strauss, plush boxes in Gustav Mahler's opera house, and mausoleums of the finest marble in Vienna's huge central cemetery. You can say what you like about the Belle Époque, but back then it really paid to be a millionaire. Heinrich's father, Theodor Gomperz, 1832 to 1912, had turned down a career all planned out for him. Instead of becoming a banker or an industrialist, he chose to devote himself to his private studies. He never needed to obtain a doctoral degree. He succeeded perfectly well without one, and soon was recognized as one of Europe's foremost classical philologists. He was duly elected a member of the Imperial Academy of Science, and was appointed full professor at the University of Vienna. His three-volume history of classical philosophy, Greek Thinkers, was a standard reference work for many decades. The interests of Gompertz's pair went far beyond the classics, though. They extended to modern thinkers such as Auguste Comte, 1798-1857, and John Stuart Mill, 1806-1873. These positivists, as they called themselves, had no truck with ancient dogmas and doctrines, and made light of all hallowed gospels of religious or metaphysical creeds. No holy writings, no mystic insights. All knowledge was to be based solely on hard-nosed scientific facts. This radically new approach shocked the stalwart keepers of philosophical traditions, such as the natural theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, the moral metaphysics of Immanuel Kant, and the absolute idealism of Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, all of which were firmly entrenched in the curricula of German-speaking universities. And so those tradition-keepers returned the fire. Thanks to their efforts, words like positivistic, materialistic, and utilitarian soon took on a highly negative flavour, connoting a shallow soul and a contemptible impotence, unable to fathom the true depths of idealistic philosophy. Theodor and Heinrich Gompertz, however, were not scared of tackling bold new intellectual ventures, and both of them admired Ernst Mach's original views, which were so refreshingly different from the traditional lore of philosophy. A lecture given by the illustrious experimental physicist captivated them. Years later, Gompertz Fies, by then himself a lecturer in philosophy, confided to Ernst Mach, "When you gave a talk on causality in the early 90s here in Vienna, I think it was at the meeting of natural scientists, my father handed me your manuscript to read. I returned it to him the next morning with the words, 'Why, here is the philosopher you are looking for to fill the third chair in philosophy.' My father took up this suggestion, as you know, and hence I, though but a student at the time, was in some sense instrumental in your appointment." Prodded by his son, Theodor Gompertz lost no time in sounding out Ernst Mach, whom he knew well from the Imperial Academy of Science. "Most respected colleague, I am broaching you today with a request of a very unusual nature, and I will make so bold as to ask you for a prompt reply. In a spontaneous fashion among myself and some colleagues, the desire has arisen to humbly ask you whether it would be hopeless for us to try and solicit you to accept one of the university chairs here in Vienna, of which some are already vacant and others soon will be." The polite request was met with a gracious and positive response, and in the end Ernst Mach accepted the new chair for the history and theory of inductive sciences, specially renamed on his behalf at the University of Vienna. Taking such a step from physics to philosophy had long been in the cards for Mach. As he himself wrote, "My life's task was to start out in science and later meet philosophy halfway." Mach makes a name for himself. Ernst Mach was born near Brno, Brünn at the time, in Moravia. He grew up in Untersiebenbrunn, a small village near Vienna, as profoundly rural as its quaint name, Amid Seven Founts, would suggest. There his father, a former schoolteacher, ran a farm, and, in his spare time, home-taught his children. At age 10, Ernst Mach was sent to a boarding school in the Benedictine monastery of Seitenstetten in Lower Austria. It soon became clear, though, that the sickly child was not up to the taxing requirements of the gymnasium, one type of Austrian secondary school, and thus it came about that little Ernst returned to rustic Untersiebenbrunn. His father, after all, was still able to provide instruction. As this left Ernst with plenty of free time, he went to work as an apprentice to a cabinet maker. One day, while rummaging through his father's bookshelves, the inquisitive apprentice stumbled upon a curious title, "Prolegomena to any future metaphysics that will be able to present itself as a science." The author's name was Immanuel Kant. This was a decisive moment, as Mach would often fondly recall. In his words, "The 15-year-old boy eagerly devoured this clearly written and relatively accessible book. It made a tremendous impression on him, destroying the boy's naive realism, whetting his appetite for the theory of knowledge, and ridding him, thanks to the influence of the metaphysician Kant, of any inclination to do metaphysics himself. I soon turned away from Kantian idealism. While still a boy, I recognized the thing in itself as a needless metaphysical invention, as a metaphysical illusion. Later on, a spirited opposition to Immanuel Kant would unite all the thinkers of the Vienna Circle. In fact, the ideas of the noted Prussian philosopher had never enjoyed great favour in Vienna. As Otto Neurath quipped, the Austrians figured out how to avoid the detour through Kant. Only Karl Popper, playing his favourite role of official opposition to the Vienna Circle, would agree with Kant, at least now and then. And later on, it came out that Kurt Gödel was a closet Kantian. Soon after his first encounter with metaphysics, the young Ernst Mach tried again to attend a gymnasium, this time at the Moravian monastery of Kremsier, today Kromjerich, run by the Order of the Piarists. His second attempt was more successful. The only disagreeable moments were provided by the endless religious exercises, which incidentally produced the opposite of their intended effect. After graduating from this school, Mach enrolled in mathematics and physics at the University of Vienna. The physics institute there was in full bloom, thanks to the high-quality research of Christian Doppler, 1803-1853, Johann Loschmidt, 1821-1895, and Josef Stefan, 1835-1893. This heady period was unprecedented. For centuries, the University of Vienna had been in the grip of the Jesuits, and the Habsburg rulers had tended to encourage music rather than the exact sciences. Thus, it was only in 1847 that an Imperial Academy of Science was established in Vienna, a couple of centuries after similar academies had been set up in Florence, London, and Paris. Even an intense lobbying effort by the polymath Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, 1646-1716, himself a one-man academy, had been to no avail. It was only with the dawn of liberalism that Austrian science was at last able to throw off its shackles. Now it was time to catch up with the rest of Europe. Young Ernst Mach was one of the talents whose moment had come. His resourcefulness and manual dexterity, due in part to his cabinet-making stint, were soon appreciated at the Physics Institute. While still a student, Mach constructed an ingenious apparatus that convincingly demonstrated the Doppler effect, namely that the perceived pitch of a sound rises when the sound's source approaches the listener. To illustrate this, Mach attached a whistle to a vertical disc. When the disc was set to spinning, the pitch of the whistle would alternately rise and fall for anyone standing in the plane of the disc, while to the ears of an observer standing along or near the axis of rotation, the pitch remained perfectly constant. At age 22, Mach received his doctorate. The following year, he earned the right to lecture at the university. Barely 26 years old, Mach became a professor in Graz, first in mathematics and later in physics. He married in 1867. That same year, Mach was appointed to a chair in experimental physics at Prague. He was not yet 30. He remained in Prague for the next 30 years, until his return to Vienna. Prague's German-speaking university had been founded in the Middle Ages, even before Vienna's. When Mach arrived, it was in the throes of a fierce political struggle. Emperor Franz Josef, after being defeated by Bismarck's Prussia in 1866, had been forced to concede far-reaching autonomy to the Hungarians, and now the Czechs were clamouring for the same rights. To the Austrians, such a thing was utterly unthinkable. Ernst Mach, during his years as dean and later as rector or head of the University of Prague, found himself caught in the middle of severe nationalistic turmoil, similar to the upheavals in Ireland. He advocated creating a new Czech university from scratch, rather than splitting up Prague's venerable old university, the Alma Mater Carolina, founded all the way back in 1348. In the end, however, his idea failed. Working on shockwaves in his physics lab was much more to Mach's taste. He soon made a name for himself, indeed quite literally so. To this day, Mach 1 refers to the speed of sound, while Mach 2 means twice the speed of sound, and so forth. Thanks to his experimental work, he became a pioneer of scientific photography. he caught images of bullets in flight, a remarkable achievement in an era when portrait photos were often blurred because the sitter grew restless as the minutes dragged by. Mark's pictures of streamlines and shockwaves thrilled his contemporaries and inspired, a few days later, the Italian futurists' attempts to capture in images the nature of great speeds. A glimpse behind the scenes. Even more than his experiments, Mach's ideas on the foundations of physics brought him worldwide acclaim. As Karl Popper would later write, "Few great men have had an intellectual impact upon the 20th century comparable to that of Ernst Mach. He influenced physics, physiology, psychology, the philosophy of science, and pure or speculative philosophy. He influenced Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, William James, Bertrand Russell, to mention just a few names. There have been scores of scientists who philosophized, and quite a few philosophers who tried their hand at science. But Mach was exceptional. He pioneered a new discipline, the philosophy of science. Science itself became the topic of inquiry. The time was ripe. No longer could science be viewed as the hobby horse of just a few isolated thinkers and visionaries. In the 19th century, science had turned into a global enterprise, spanning the generations. It was universally recognized as the engine driving the Industrial Revolution. The question could no longer wait. Given that human progress is based on science, what is science itself based on? To understand the underpinnings of knowledge was and still is one of philosophy's principal tasks. How do we know that there is a tree over there? Or that Napoleon once lived, or that a dog can feel pain. Mach addressed a more practical matter, one that could not be sidestepped or shrugged off, the foundations of scientific knowledge, the growing, hard-fought knowledge that belongs to all and that affects everybody. He addressed these issues in three books, The Science of Mechanics, 1883, Principles of the Theory of Heat, 1896, and Principles of Physical Optics, which appeared posthumously in 1921. What is the true meaning of physical concepts such as force, heat, and entropy? What is matter? How do we measure acceleration? Mach tackled such questions from the bottom up, starting with the simplest observations and continuing with a critical analysis of the historical roots. From the start, he intuited the intimate link between the philosophy of science and the history of science. The first paragraph of The Science of Mechanics comes right to the point. The present volume is not a treatise about applications of the principles of mechanics. Its aim is to clear up ideas, expose the real significance of the topic, and get rid of metaphysical obscurities. Then Mach proceeds, "The gist and kernel of mechanical ideas has, in almost every case, been developed through the investigation of very simple, special examples of mechanical processes. The historical analysis of the way such examples were first understood will always be the most effective and natural means to reveal this kernel. We may even claim that it is the only way that can lead to a full understanding of the general results of mechanics." Textbooks, then as now, aim to lead the student as quickly as possible to the state of the art. But for a critical analysis of the tools, the concepts and methods, it helps to know how they evolved. Thus, Mach's approach to physics was historical. On the other hand, he had little interest in the history of philosophy, in contrast to traditional philosophers. Modern times had arrived. It was best to start from scratch, building up from the basics. With the acumen of a psychologist, Mach analyzes concepts such as physical force, for example, a notion that, although it is familiar to everyone, took a long time to emerge with scientific clarity. Let us direct our attention to the concept of force. Force is a circumstance leading to movement. The circumstances giving rise to movement that are best known to us are our own acts of volition, the results of nerve impulses. In the movements that we ourselves initiate, we always feel a push or a pull. From this simple fact arose our habit of imagining all circumstances that give rise to movement as akin to volitional acts, and thus as pushes or pulls. A physicist views the vast universe as filled with all kinds of forces, a concept derived through a long and arduous intellectual process. It seems odd to ground this notion in intimate bodily sensations first experienced as a toddler. But what else can we do? Whenever we attempt to discount this conception of force as subjective, animistic, and unscientific, we invariably fail. Surely it cannot profit us to do violence to our own natural thoughts and to deliberately inhibit our minds in this regard. In this way, Mach reduced physical concepts to directly experienced sensations such as pushes and pulls, that is, to sensory impressions. Hence his physical interests led him inevitably toward physiology. In this field, too, he struck gold. For instance, he pinpointed the sense of balance in the inner ear, thus adding a sixth sense to Aristotle's famous list of five. This discovery was also made, roughly at the same time, by Joseph Breuer, 1842-1925, a Viennese physician who later, along with Sigmund Freud, contributed to the founding of psychoanalysis. Still later, Robert Baragne, 1876-1936, extended Breuer's and Mach's findings and was rewarded with a Nobel Prize in medicine, the first one to go to Vienna. Why was Vienna such a fertile ground for the study of dizziness? Might it have been due to the then prevailing craze for the waltz? Thrifty thinking. Science has to restrict itself to empirical facts, but it is obviously more than a mere stockpiling of them. For Mach, the main aim of science was an economy of thought, that is, to describe as much as possible in as concise a manner as possible. Newton's law of gravitation, for instance, covers, in one short equation, countless phenomena, ranging from the fall of an apple to the orbit of the moon. Mach writes, "All of science tries to replace or economize experience by mental models, since models are easier to deal with than experiences, and can even replace them in some situations. By recognizing science's fundamentally economical nature, we rid science of all mysticism." Mach was radical. In his view, theories serve solely to simplify thought. Natural laws are mere prescriptions guiding our expectations, and causality is nothing but the regular connection of events. In this sense, causal links do not provide an additional explanation. Most researchers ascribe a reality beyond the human mind to the basic concepts of physics, such as mass, force, and atom, whereas they have no other purpose than to connect experiences in an economical fashion. Moreover, it is commonly believed that these forces and masses constitute the true field of inquiry, and that if they were specified, everything else would follow directly from the equilibrium and the motion of these masses. But this view confuses reality with representation, argued Mach. Force, mass, and atom are mere concepts, just intellectual props. Someone who knew the world only through the theatre, and who came across the mechanical contraptions behind the scenes, would likewise come to think that the real world needs a backstage. In that sense, we should not confuse the foundations of the real world with the intellectual props that serve to evoke that world on the stage of our thoughts. Economic principles govern not only the activity of science, but also its teaching. Instructing individuals in science aims at sparing them the task of acquiring experience on their own, by providing them instead with the experience acquired by others. When he was young, Mach had had unhappy experiences at school. Hoping to spare others a similar fate, he campaigned tirelessly for school reforms and for improved curricula. He wrote a textbook for secondary schools. Despite the author's renown, it took no small effort to get it approved by the Ministry of Education. Brilliance is suspect. A born teacher, Mach wrote splendid essays explaining science to the public, was an advocate for adult education, and never ceased to fight against the ingeniously contrived barriers which barbarically prevent mature persons of talent, who have missed out on the usual schooling, from attending institutions of higher education and entering into learned professions. For Mach, education was enlightenment. "I will not meet any opposition when I claim that without at least an elementary instruction in mathematics and science, man will remain a stranger in this world, a stranger in the culture that supports him. Culture was not to be reserved to just one of the two sexes, by the way. Mach used the word Mensch, human being. Not only in scientific theories, but also in school studies, our thoughts can get tangled up in the backstage clutter of abstract concepts, like a fly in a spider web. Science education was still in an embryonic stage. Without any doubt, far more can be expected from the teaching of science and mathematics once a more natural method of teaching is adopted. This means in particular that young people should not be ruined by being exposed too early to abstraction. The most effective way to disrupt the process of abstraction is to embrace it too early. And in another passage, Mach writes, "I know of nothing more depressing than those poor people who have learnt too much. What they have acquired is a spiderweb of thoughts, too weak to offer support, but complicated enough to confuse them. Mach wanted to do away with this spiderweb." The ego and its sensations. Mach's most important philosophical work appeared in 1886, The Analysis of Sensations. It opens with anti-metaphysical introductory remarks, a clarion call for striking down Immanuel Kant's Ding an sich, or thing in itself, and for that matter any thing or substance. Mach considered such notions to be useless dead weights, superfluous abstractions lacking any connection to our sense organs. Since science for him was economic thinking, it had no room for such extravagances. Fleeting sensory impressions are all we have to go by. Mach's empiricism was all-encompassing. For him, all knowledge had to be grounded in experience, and all experience grounded in perception, hence in sense data, which is to say, in his sensations. Colours, sounds, temperatures, pressures, spaces, times, and so forth, are connected with one another in manifold ways, and attached to them are moods, feelings, and desires. In this vast web, only that which is relatively solid and permanent stands out prominently, engraving itself on the memory and expressing itself in language. A relatively greater permanence is exhibited by certain patterns of colours, sounds, pressures, and the like, which are bound together in space and time. Such patterns are recognised as objects, and they are assigned names. But in no way are these objects truly permanent. Within such a pattern, primordial sensory elements can shift, like the colourful pebbles in a kaleidoscope. A pencil held up before us in the air is perceived by us as straight, yet dip it at an angle into water, and we see it as bent. We will say that the pencil merely appears to be bent, but is in reality straight. But what allows us to declare one fact to be reality while demoting the other fact to the status of mere appearance? Indeed, why should tactile sensations be privileged as opposed to visual ones? Why should we trust our fingers more than our eyes? Or should we? The objects that we perceive consist merely of bundles of sense data linked together in regular ways. There exists no further object independent of our sensations, no thing in itself. We thus know only appearances, never a thing in itself, just the world of our own sensations. Therefore, we can never know whether there exists a thing in itself. Consequently, it makes no sense to talk about such notions. And this leads us to the next unsettling thought. I do not exist any more than any other thing does. Among the relatively long-lasting patterns of memories, moods, feelings, and so on, there is one pattern that is attached to a special body, and that pattern is called I, or ego. Yet this ego is just as transient as are all other things. This was a topic that Mach would take up again and again. A striking experience had once left an indelible mark on him. One bright summer's day in the open air, the world, with my ego in it, suddenly appeared to me as nothing but one tightly bundled mass of sensations, just bundled together more tightly in the ego. Had Mach been a mystic, he would have taken this as a flash of enlightenment. However, being a hard-nosed physicist, he merely drew an ironic sketch back in his study, calling it the ego inspecting itself. The ego consists of sensations. Behind them there lurks, well, nothing, nothing at all, and nothing more remains to be said about it. I experience green means that the element of greenness occurs within a certain pattern of other elements, sensations, memories. When I can no longer experience green, when I die, then these elements will no longer occur in their usual familiar groupings. That is the whole story. No ego will remain. The ego cannot be saved. The notion of the unsavable ego became a catchword with the writers of Young Vienna. Mach's world without objects or substances, consisting entirely of sensory impressions, was impressionistic by definition, and thus completely in tune with the tenor of the times, the heady zeitgeist of the Belle Époque. In the nearby Berggasse, a cigar-smoking Sigmund Freud dissected the soul by closely tracking his patient's associations, as well as those of his chief patient, namely himself. The poet Hugo von Hofmannsthal, young Vienna's Wunderkind, attended Mach's lectures. Vienna's foremost writer, Arthur Schnitzler, adopted Mach's perspective in his inner monologues and dissolved the ego into chains of associations and bundles of sensations. Those in the fine arts chimed in and painted not things but light. The remarkably versatile historian and cabaret performer Egon Friedel, 1878-1938, pithily summarized the work of the Impressionists. In one brief word, they painted Mach. In the salons of fin de siècle Vienna, the venerable physicist-philosopher with the prophet's head became a lionized celebrity. True, Mach dressed in a somewhat slovenly manner, and his hair was often dishevelled, but the waltz-giddy beau monde was struck by this homespun genius, and was itching to hear him hold forth on his original views. And Mach came through for them, finding just the right words to thrill the Viennese society of artists and critics, countesses and mistresses, patrons of art and entrepreneurs. When I say the ego cannot be saved, I mean that it consists solely of man's way of relating to things and to phenomena, that the ego totally dissolves into that which can be felt, heard, viewed, or touched. Everything is fleeting. Ours is a world without substance, consisting solely of colours, shapes, and sounds. Its reality is in eternal motion, colourful as a chameleon. The Austrian writer Hermann Bahr, 1863-1934, waxed ecstatic. In this phrase, the ego cannot be saved, I found spelled out what had tormented me for these last 3 years. The ego is a mere name. It is a mere illusion. It is a quick fix that we exploit to put some order into our thoughts. Nothing truly exists but combinations of colours, sounds, temperatures, pressures, spaces, times, and their associated moods, feelings, and desires. Everything is eternally changing. The spell cast by these ideas was not restricted to Vienna's haute bourgeoisie. Mach also attained a particular eminence among Marxists. More than a few of them hailed his work as a fresh new approach to materialism. The Austro-Marxists proved particularly receptive, so much so that Vladimir Lenin felt obliged to call these unruly dissidents to order. In his 1908 book, Materialism and Imperio-Criticism, written expressly to oppose their heresy, he thundered, "All our Machists are deeply mired in idealism." Mach must have felt surprised at being accused of idealism, but by claiming to resolve matter into mere bundles of sensations, he certainly was a threat to materialists. Foremost among the Machists in braving Lenin's ire was a young theoretical physicist named Friedrich Adler, 1879-1960. He was the son of Victor Adler, the highly respected founder of the Austrian Social Democratic Workers' Party, and he looked uncannily like a clone of his father. 10 years after Lenin's attack on Mach and his disciples, Friedrich Adler fired back with a book of his own, entitled Ernst Mach's Victory over Mechanical Materialism. He wrote it while in a cell on death row, but more on that later. Indeed, although Friedrich Adler would never be a member of the Vienna Circle, the side plot in which he stars will form an important part of the Circle's tale. 3 years after his appointment to the University of Vienna, Mach suffered a paralyzing stroke during a long train trip. He was no longer able to move his right arm or right leg. In 1901, after making valiant attempts to resume his lectures, he finally had no choice but to resign for reasons of ill health. He declined the emperor's offer to make him a baron, as it ran against his democratic convictions, but he could not resist being named a lifelong member of the Austrian House of Lords, or Herrenhaus, along with his trusted old friend Theodor Gomperz. Despite his infirmity, the aging Mach remained as intellectually agile as ever, ceaselessly sparring with some of the foremost scientists of his time, such as Ludwig Boltzmann and Max Planck. A halo of controversies surrounded him. Indeed, his opinions, while seductively unconventional, raised substantial problems when pursued carefully, such as, if all science rests on sense data, then what about things that cannot be perceived? Must we discard them as extravagant fictions? And what about other people's sense data, which we ourselves can never experience? Must we discard them, too? Mach constantly had to defend himself against charges of being a solipsist, he who had proclaimed the end of the ego. Boltzmann's formula. Ernst Mach was not the first physicist to call into question the ego's existence. A century before, in a similar vein, Georg Lichtenberg, 1742-1799, had quipped that we should say, "It thinks," rather than "I think." And Mach's Viennese colleague Ludwig Boltzmann clearly shared Lichtenberg's outlook when he railed at the bizarre opinion that we can think as we choose to think. The lives and thoughts of Mach and Boltzmann were closely intertwined. Ludwig Boltzmann, born in 1844 in Vienna, came from a background as modestly middle class as Ernst Mach's. Soon after Ludwig's birth, his father, a tax official, was transferred to the finance department of the town of Linz. There, the boy's remarkable talents, especially in mathematics and music, were quickly noticed. And much like Ernst Mach as a boy, little Boltzmann was privately tutored before entering the gymnasium. His young piano teacher, a certain Anton Bruckner, was just starting to make a name for himself as the town organist of Linz. When Ludwig was 15, his father died. His widowed mother spent her entire inheritance on the education of her sons. After Ludwig had finished his gymnasium studies, the family returned to Vienna. There, the young man studied mathematics and physics, got his doctorate in 1866, and obtained a lectureship, just like Mach, at the tender age of 23. But Boltzmann's interests focused more on theoretical than on experimental physics. Later, he would joke, "I disdain experiments the way a banker disdains coins." His professor, Joseph Stefan, had urged him to read James Clerk Maxwell's treatise on physics, handing him an English grammar book as well, for at the time Boltzmann did not speak one word of the language. He proved to be a quick learner. Already his second paper, On the Mechanical Interpretation of the Second Law of Thermodynamics, turned out to be groundbreaking. Soon he was recognized as the physicist most able to grasp and extend Maxwell's work on electromagnetism and thermodynamics. By the time he was 25, Boltzmann was appointed full professor of mathematical physics in Graz. In 1875, he became professor of mathematics in Vienna, but remained there for just 3 years. Then he returned to Graz, accepting a chair in experimental physics for which Mach had also been under consideration. Of course, Boltzmann did not really disdain experiments, as he had claimed, and was delighted to accept such a chair. But there was also another reason behind his return to Graz. During his previous stay in that city, he had met a young lady named Henrietta von Eiglinger, who was uncommonly fond of mathematics and physics. Boltzmann convinced the authorities to allow her to attend university lectures, something unheard of at the time. His motive was not entirely selfless. In 1875, he asked in a letter for Henrietta's hand. He wrote, No matter how little I believe that emotions could or should ever be inhibited by the cold and inexorable consequences of the exact sciences, it nevertheless behoves us, as the representatives thereof, to act only after well-considered judgment, rather than to follow fleeting whims. As a mathematician, you surely do not find numbers which rule the world to be unpoetic. And so, my salary is currently 2,400 florins per year. My active annual bonus is 800 florins. Last year, my fees from lecturing and examining amounted to about 1,000 florins. This latter revenue, however, is subject to change from year to year. The sum total is not small, and will suffice to keep a household going. However, in view of the enormous rise in prices these days, it will not afford you many distractions and amusements. Boltzmann's well-penned, if starchy, proposal was accepted, and the marriage resulted in 5 children, the same number as in Ernst Mach's family. The next 15 years in Graz were Boltzmann's most productive period, not just in terms of progeny, but also in scientific output. He became one of the founders of the kinetic theory of gases, which provides a mechanistic underpinning to thermodynamics. Not only was this a major breakthrough for physics, but it was also philosophically relevant, as it provided a causal explanation based on a mechanical model, a feature that Mach was slow to accept. According to Boltzmann, gases consist of particles that are constantly rushing about and colliding like billiard balls. The greater the temperature, the faster they move, although they don't all have the same velocity. As they collide with each other and with the walls, thus exerting measurable pressure on the walls, some speed up while others slow down. Boltzmann's equations, statistically summarizing such particles' behavior, soon became central pillars of physics, and today they play a pivotal role in many areas of technology, for instance, in the theory of semiconductors. Of course, gas particles are not really miniature billiard balls. In light of this, shouldn't we say that the statistical theory of gases, rather than providing an explanation, merely provides a picture? But then again, aren't the tiny particles in the container far more real than a mere picture? And doesn't their constant whizzing about in fact cause the pressure? Even the mysterious notion of entropy, which always increases with time for any closed system, becomes intuitive and understandable when rephrased in terms of statistical mechanics. According to Boltzmann, entropy is related to the probability of the state of the particles in the vessel, which is greater when the system is more random, just as a shuffled deck of cards is more likely to look random than to be in pristine order. In other words, entropy is a measure of the disorder of the system when examined on a microscopic level. And it should come as no surprise to learn that disorder increases with time if things are left to themselves. Just look at your desk. Mach, however, remained unimpressed. To reconcile the molecular hypothesis with entropy is a bonus for the hypothesis, but not for the law of entropy. In his eyes, the sole duty of a theory was to concisely relate observables, such as pressure or temperature. Boltzmann's statistical recasting of thermodynamics had therefore stepped out of bounds. Moreover, the new theory raised some thorny issues. For instance, if disorder always increases with time, then this fact must define the direction of time's flow. To be concrete, suppose all the molecules in a gas are placed in the left half of the container and are then released. As they bash into each other, they will quickly spread all around the container. If left to themselves, they will never again occupy just the left half of the container. Things will never go back to the simpler, more ordered state in which they started. At least, no such reversal has ever been observed so far. And so this effect of ever-increasing disorder clearly distinguishes past from future, thus creating an unambiguous arrow of time. 2 serious objections were raised to Boltzmann's theory, and to this day neither of them has been settled in a generally accepted way. They are called the paradox of recurrence and the paradox of reversibility. The paradox of reversibility was first raised by Boltzmann's fatherly friend and mentor, Josef Loschmidt. The laws of mechanics, which govern the collision of billiard balls and of all objects, do not distinguish future from past. Thus, if we watch a film of billiard balls colliding frictionlessly on a table, we cannot tell whether it is running forward or backward. But if we watch a film of a drop of cream dissolving in a cup of coffee, we can easily tell. So how does time acquire its arrow? The paradox of recurrence originated with the German mathematician Ernst Zermelo, 1871-1953. According to the laws of probability, every state that has been reached once must be reached again and again and again. This is an ironclad theorem. Hence, the particles in the container eventually must all return to the left half of the container in which they were originally confined, except that they don't. Such tricky riddles can be troubling for even the most cool and composed of thinkers, and cool and composed was hardly what Boltzmann was. Professor Restless. All throughout Boltzmann's life, his temper had oscillated between extremes. Jokingly, he ascribed his mercurial streak to having been born in the wee hours of Ash Wednesday, the night between Carnival and Lent. His psychological agitation increased with age, and this started to worry colleagues and friends. He accepted a professorship in Berlin, only to give it up right away, and yet, a short while later, he reasserted his interest in it. In 1896, he accepted a chair in Munich, and soon thereafter a different one in Vienna. In the year 1900, after endless vacillations, he accepted an offer from the University of Leipzig. But then, in 1902, like a gas molecule bouncing about in a container, he returned to Vienna. On this occasion, he became his own successor, as he gleefully pointed out on resuming his chair. One usually starts out one's inaugural lecture with a paean praising one's predecessor. Today, however, I can fortunately spare myself this oft-challenging task, for the fact is, I am my own predecessor. The authorities were not so amused by Boltzmann's fickleness. This time Boltzmann was required to pledge his word of honour to Emperor Franz Joseph himself. Never again would he accept an offer from abroad. No more job-hopping. But Boltzmann's love for travel did not abate in the least. He proceeded to visit Constantinople, Smyrna, Algiers, and Lisbon, and he also crossed the Atlantic 3 times to travel across the United States. In A German Professor's Trip to El Dorado, he recounted the third of these voyages, which included a brief stay at the newly founded Stanford University, in a humorous manner. He called himself German rather than Austrian, as he was referring to his cultural background rather than his nationality. By that time, Boltzmann enjoyed worldwide fame. 2 of his former collaborators in Graz, Walter Nernst, 1864-1941, and Svante Arrhenius, 1859-1927, would later receive the Nobel Prize. Among his Viennese students were the brilliant and captivating Lise Meitner, 1878-1968, who later co-discovered the fission of uranium, as well as the theoreticians Paul Ehrenfest, 1880-1933, and Philipp Frank, 1884-1966. The Great Debate. The paths of Mach and Boltzmann crossed frequently. This couldn't help but lead to a certain degree of rivalry, even though one was an experimentalist and the other was a theoretician. Thus, in 1874, Ernst Mach was elected to the Imperial Academy of Science, but not Ludwig Boltzmann, who had also been on the ballot. Conversely, in 1894, it was Boltzmann who was selected for the chair in physics at the University of Vienna, but not Mach, who had also expressed an interest in it. The two physicists respected each other highly, but their courtesy could not hide the fact that they tended to hold different views. This tension climaxed in their famous debate on the reality of atoms. Do atoms truly exist, or are they just mental objects, something like the concept of a point? The controversy polarized the world of physics and chemistry. Nobel Prize winners joined the fray, such as Wilhelm Ostwald, 1853-1932, on Mach's side, and Max Planck, 1858-1947, on Boltzmann's, although Planck had only recently shifted sides in the controversy. Later, Karl Popper would write, "Both Boltzmann and Mach had large camps of supporters among physicists, and they were engaged in an almost deadly battle, a battle over what kind of research should be done in physics. An almost deadly battle is obviously an exaggeration, but the debate was extremely heated. Boltzmann needed atoms for his thermodynamics, and he wrote a passionate plea titled On the Indispensability of Atoms in Science. However, since atoms cannot be directly perceived, Ernst Mach treated them as mere models, constructions of the mind, not all that different from his old bugaboo, Kant's thing in itself. Whenever atoms were mentioned, Mach would slyly ask, with a clear Viennese lilt in his voice, "Did you ever see one?" Today, nanotechnology allows us to see atoms, in a sense, and in that sense the debate has been settled, and in Boltzmann's favour. But in essence, it was a debate about a question of philosophy rather than one of physics, and in that sense it is still far from settled. The debate on whether atoms exist turned less on atoms themselves than on what to exist means. Boltzmann's Natural Philosophy. When, after Mach's stroke, it became clear that he could no longer give lectures, a search was started for a successor. It promised to be difficult and time-consuming. That is why Mach's lectures, but not his chair, were temporarily entrusted to Boltzmann. This seemed rather ironic, given their public disagreements, but a tradition of sorts was emerging, with Boltzmann becoming one more physicist to teach philosophy at Vienna's university. Boltzmann's opening lecture in 1903 proved to be a spectacular success. Newspapers reported that there had been a nearly life-threatening throng, with the eager crowd stretching way out into the street. Upon learning of this, even the old emperor became curious and invited Boltzmann for a private audience. The first words of Boltzmann's first philosophical lecture alluded to his illustrious predecessor Mach, and not just as a perfunctory tip of the hat. After courteously saying, "To praise Mach would be like carrying owls to Athens, or to substitute an English idiom, like carrying coals to Newcastle," he quickly turned to his true point. "I thus believe that I can best honour Mach by doing my utmost to further develop his ideas with the help of my own." Of course, in this sentence the phrase "to further develop" meant, in only a slightly coded way, "to fully destroy." Knowing that everyone present must have been wondering why he had been given the honour of taking on Ernst Mach's philosophy course, Boltzmann promptly brought up the atomic debate. "Up till now, I have written just one single essay on philosophy, and I was led to doing so by pure chance. One time, in the meeting room of the Academy of Science, I was hotly debating with a group of academicians, including His Honour the Court Counsellor Professor Mach, on the value of atomic theories, a dispute that had once again taken on great intensity among physicists. Quite out of the blue, in that distinguished group, Mach tersely declared, 'I don't believe that atoms exist.' This remark just kept on echoing in my mind." Although they belonged to opposite camps concerning the existence of atoms, the two physicists were united in their distrust of metaphysics. Boltzmann was not one to mince words. "Whereas I felt some qualms about plunging myself into philosophy, philosophers seem to have none about intruding into science. I first encountered philosophers a long time ago, and at that time I had no idea what they meant by their utterances, and therefore I tried to become better informed about the basics of philosophy." Boltzmann's weapon of choice was the club rather than the foil. "To head straight into the deepest depths, I first turned to Hegel, but oh, what obscure, vacuous balderdash did I find there. My unlucky star then ushered me from Hegel to Schopenhauer." At the time, Schopenhauer was extremely popular in Vienna. Like a bull, Boltzmann charged at him head-on, and in doing so he created a furore. The Viennese public, intoxicated, flocked to his lectures, avidly hoping for more fun and more blood. But when, later in the course, Boltzmann turned to the foundations of mathematics, he rapidly lost much of his audience. "My lectures on philosophy," as he ruefully wrote, "did not have the hoped-for success. I talked about set theory, non-Euclidean geometry, and the like. This proved too mathematical for my public, and many gave up. but Boltzmann saw no alternative. He flatly stated, "What the brain is to man, mathematics is to science." It is not easy to understand, however, why mathematics turns out to be so central to physics. The truth of mathematical propositions does not hinge on sense data, after all. How, then, can mathematics agree with Marx's radically empiricist viewpoint? "No equation," said Boltzmann, "ever represents any phenomenon with absolute precision. Each equation is an idealization, stressing commonalities and neglecting differences, and therefore going beyond experience." Both atoms and differential equations are abstract concepts that go beyond experience. This was bound to make them suspicious for Ernst Mach. But Boltzmann did not sympathize with such qualms, being far too much a pragmatist, a recent term, by the way, that had become popular in the New World. Mach's view of science as an economical way of thinking did not convince Boltzmann either. "We hesitate to ascribe to mere thriftiness of thinking the exploration of the physical and chemical nature of stars, or of stellar motions and interstellar distances, not to mention the invention of the microscope and the discovery of the origins of our diseases." Boltzmann came out with only a few philosophical writings, found mainly in his Principles of Natural Philosophy, spelled with two Fs. With that title, he was making fun of a then-popular movement to reform German spelling, which in the end went nowhere. The notes from his philosophy course remained unpublished until 80 years after his death, yet they still make good reading. Much of Boltzmann's thinking seems remarkably modern, for instance his interest in the analysis of language and in the theory of evolution. Boltzmann saw traditional philosophy as having been rendered obsolete by Darwin's great insights, and in fact he aspired to become the Darwin of inanimate matter. More than a decade before Einstein's general theory of relativity, Boltzmann toyed with the idea that space was curved. His students summarized this in a cute, though rather clumsy, couplet. "Tritt der gewöhnliche Mensch auf den Würm, so wird sich krümmen. Ludwig Boltzmann tritt auf. Siehe, es krümmt sich der Raum." A worm stepped on by a man will coil. Enter Boltzmann, though, and space itself will roil. Boltzmann's demeanour may have struck his listeners as majestic, but deep inside he was wrestling with philosophy and wallowing in self-doubt. Despite his many harsh words about philosophers, he did not believe that the problems of metaphysics had all been solved. He suffered from metaphysics, an incurable illness. Metaphysics appears to exert an irresistible charm on the human mind, and this temptation, despite all our vain attempts to lift the veil, has not lost any of its intensity. It seems impossible to squelch our inborn urge to philosophize. Looking for the final cure. Boltzmann was well aware that the habit of asking questions, though usually healthy, can lead a person to an obsession with sterile pseudo-problems, much as a baby grows so accustomed to sucking at the breast that eventually it will contentedly suck on a mere pacifier. For example, the instinctive urge to always ask for a cause may lead us to ask for the cause that lies behind the law of cause and effect. This would surely be carrying things too far. But who will tell us where to stop? Will philosophy? Boltzmann wished that that were the case. "Which definition of philosophy imposes itself with irresistible force upon me? I have always suffered from the frightening feeling, weighing down on me like a nightmare, that great riddles, such as how I can exist, or that a world exists at all, or why the world is exactly this way and not some other way, will remain for ever unsolved and unsolvable. Whichever branch of science would succeed in solving such riddles seemed the greatest to my eyes, and thus the true queen of sciences, and this is what I called philosophy." Alas, the true queen was in exile, and her riddles have no solution. And yet those riddles never cease to haunt us. "My knowledge in science increased. I took in Darwin's teachings and learned from them that I had been mistaken in asking these questions, since they had no solution. But nonetheless, the questions invariably returned, and always with compelling intensity. If such questions are illegitimate, why then can't they be discarded? and to make matters worse, countless others rise in their wake. If there is something else behind perception, how can we ever find out what it is? Or if, on the other hand, there is none, does this mean that a landscape on Mars fails to exist simply because no conscious being ever gazes down on it? If none of these questions makes sense, then why can't we discard them all? Or what can we do to squelch them once and for all? This last question, more than any other, haunted Boltzmann. Not only is there no sensible answer, there is no sensible question. So why can't we stop asking, then? My current hypothesis is totally different from the doctrine that there are certain questions that lie beyond the realm of human understanding. Indeed, according to that doctrine, this would indicate a lack or a flaw in the human capacity for knowledge, whereas I maintain that the existence of such questions or problems is an illusion of the senses. On first glance, it seems surprising that the urge to answer these pressing questions does not fade away, even after they have been recognized as illusions. Apparently, our habit of thinking is too ingrained for us to be able to let them go. It is precisely as with the well-known optical illusions, which persist even after their cause has been made clear. Hence the feeling of insecurity, the lack of satisfaction, which overwhelms the scientist who dares to philosophize. Insecurity, indeed. A thinker who loses control of his thinking is but one step removed from madness. Unable to throw off his haunting obsessions, Boltzmann slept poorly, and his neurasthenia gradually worsened. His nearsightedness became so extreme that he had to don 3 pairs of glasses, one on top of the other, whenever he wanted to play the piano. Headaches, exhaustion, depression, and a terrible, agitated restlessness made his life a burden. Thinking, for him, was becoming agony. In his philosophical distress, Boltzmann turned to Franz Brentano, 1838-1917, a charismatic thinker who embodied a pre-Raphaelite's idea of a philosopher. Brentano had once been a Catholic priest, and thus a professional comforter of souls, which was just what Boltzmann needed. When Brentano had married, he had been forced to resign his position at the University of Vienna, to the great consternation of his students. He had been extremely popular there. Among his aficionados was an audacious young medical student named Sigmund Freud. In one of his lectures, Brentano argued that it makes no sense to speak of the unconscious. The young medical student took note of this claim, and had second thoughts about it. But whatever doubts Freud had did nothing to diminish his admiration for his professor. It was actually Brentano's vacant philosophy chair that had been renamed and offered to Ernst Mach. However, after stepping down, Brentano kept on lecturing in a private capacity. He was hardly in need of a salary, for his wife belonged to the Lieben family, one of Vienna's foremost banking dynasties. But then she died, and after that he moved out of the glittering Palais Todesco on Vienna's Ringstrasse and settled in the hills outside Florence. Gradually his eyesight failed him. Boltzmann asked for Brentano's philosophical help and guidance, writing to him, "The irrepressible urge to philosophize is like nausea caused by a migraine, like wanting to throw up something that is not there." But despite the nausea, he could not stop. The sublime, majestic task of philosophy is to make things clear, to finally cure humankind of this migraine. Increasingly often, Boltzmann had to cancel his lectures because of ill health. Stays in fancy spas did not help. From a sanatorium he wrote to his wife, "I'm sleeping very poorly, and am completely beside myself with sadness. If only somebody would come and fetch me, I would leave at once. They don't allow me to leave by myself. Please come, Mama, or just send someone. Please have mercy, and don't ask for anyone's advice. Just decide on your own. Please, forgive me everything." In the spring of 1906, Boltzmann had to cancel all his lectures. And then, on September the 5th of that year, he committed suicide while on holiday on the Adriatic coast, near the castle of Duino, an eerily romantic spot where the poet Rainer Maria Rilke would later write his famous elegies. Boltzmann's daughter, when she returned from some errands, discovered her father's body dangling on a short rope affixed to the cross of a window. In an obituary in the distinguished German newspaper Die Zeit, his former rival Ernst Mach wrote, "In well-informed circles it was known that Boltzmann was not likely ever to resume his university chair again. There was talk of the need to keep him constantly under close observation, because he had already attempted suicide before." And Franz Brentano wrote in a letter to Mach, reminiscing about their common successor Boltzmann, who now had preceded them in death, "This extremely talented scientist lacked neither philosophical interests nor the pure love of truth. And yet, into what strange speculations didn't he enter? You yourself certainly know a great deal about him, but not as much as I do, if it is true, as he told me, that I was the first human being with patience enough to hear him out to the end. And very honestly, doing so was not an easy task." Eloping with Karen. Old, crippled, and growing ever more deaf, Ernst Mach survived his younger rival by 10 years. The last major work of his to appear during his lifetime was Knowledge and Error, based on his earlier philosophical lectures at the University of Vienna. Mach did not intend to introduce a new philosophy, but to get rid of an old and stale one. The same hygienic goals were later pursued by Ludwig Wittgenstein and the Vienna Circle, cleansing the stable, airing the brain out. Mach stressed that he was no philosopher at all, but a scientist, and that a scientist can rest content when he recognizes, in the conscious psychic activity of his research, a methodically purified, sharpened, and refined version of the instinctual activities occurring every day in the natural and cultural life of animals and people. Maybe scientists, knowing when to stop, were wiser than philosophers. Science has progressed almost more through deciding what to ignore than through deciding what to study. In his notes, which now he had to scrawl with his left hand or type on a machine specially adapted to his needs, Mach returned again and again to his firmest lifelong convictions. The aim of science, the fitting of facts into thoughts, and the fitting of thoughts to each other. The ego varies. It changes and expands, or shrinks. Sometimes it vanishes altogether, and not necessarily in the unhappiest moments. Sensations are the common elements of all possible physical and psychic experiences. Given this, many troubling pseudo-problems simply go away. These three quotes encapsulate for posterity what Ernst Mach stands for. As a kind of personal motto, he added, "To give up nonsense is not to resign." Ernst Mach, the feisty philosopher of the unsavable ego, bore his infirmity with a serene, almost Buddha-like detachment. One of his visitors wrote, "I faced a saint who had overcome the last traces of earthly gravity, and in whose eyes there shone the unflinching kindness reached through universal understanding." And the American psychologist William James, 1842-1910, who founded philosophical pragmatism, enthusiastically declared after an encounter with Mach, "I do not think that anyone has ever left me with such a strong impression of unadulterated genius." In 1913, Ernst Mach moved into his son's home in Munich. Dutifully informing the Imperial Academy of Science of his change in address, he added with a literary wink, "Should this letter be my last, I ask you merely to assume that Karen, that old joker, has run off with me to a station so remote that it does not yet belong to the International Postal Union." In 1916, Ernst Mach died at age 78. In an obituary, Einstein praised his grandiose one-sidedness and claimed that even those who view themselves as Mach's opponents are hardly aware of how much of his viewpoint they have soaked up, so to speak, with their mother's milk.